Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com, and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, brain hackers. Today I'm talking with Wendy Russell. She is the founder of Brown Paper Press and the publisher of an amazing book that delves into the difficulty and shame and a story behind conversion therapy. We're going to get into talking about this incredibly controversial topic about how for so many years, there's been this cottage industry around converting homosexuals and, you know, this particular man's story as well. So we're going to get into it. Hey there, Wendy, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now, this, of course, is an incredibly, you know, somber topic, but you're here as part of our Brains Behind the Book series where we're talking to publishers. And we were going to talk originally about the publishing industry and authors. But when I heard about this topic of this story, I just had to do a video on it, hoping that it would, you know, reach more eyeballs. Tell me this book that you did.
So this is a book called The Inheritance of Shame. It's a memoir by a man who endured 6 years of a form of conversion therapy in his native Vancouver. It was not a biblical-based conversion therapy, which we normally have here in the States, but he went to a psychiatrist when he was in his early 20s because he was depressed and had really hit rock bottom in his life. And the therapist convinced him that it was because he was a homosexual and because he had to get rid of those urges in order to come out of his depression. And so it just spiraled into this nightmare situation where he was medicated and he was put in a home with other patients and underwent this sort of primal therapy and rebirthing and all kinds of stuff. It's a fascinating story. So
yeah, so I know a thing or two about this with my background in brain stuff, and it's appropriate we're doing this on Brain Hackers. This is a dark chapter of science, and what we have to do is be humble and realize that science often gets it wrong. And this person, this therapist, I assume, at least, you know, in the beginning, seems probably idealistic, maybe thinks that he even has found the cure for this ailment because of essentially the dominant belief that homosexuality was somehow aberrant. He was essentially trying to figure out, you know, why does it exist? Why does it happen? And this sort of rebirthing therapy, if I know my stories correct, it's something along the lines of the theory that, nurture over nature, that somehow in your process of being born and being raised, you were converted or turned gay, and that somehow, you know, by going through psychological therapy, you can reverse that process. Is that about the theory?
Yeah, that's exactly what my understanding of it is. And I'm sure everyone's take on it is a little different because their experiences are a little different. But with Peter's story, he was made to believe that he had been molested in a bathroom. It was a brief experience, but it obviously was very heavy to him as a child. And he was made to believe that was a pivotal moment in his life, and that is a common belief that, you know, if you have some kind of a homosexual experience as a child, as an assault or abuse, then that is somehow going to turn you into this. And I think it's just this idea, you know, the foundational idea that it's homosexuality is not natural, and so something must have happened to you in order to make you this way.
Well, I think also it bumps up against the idea that, not the idea, but the very well-known trauma that, the very well-known issue that young people relive their trauma. It's a very well-known phenomenon. It's incredibly heartbreaking, but essentially, you know, people who are abused at a young age, that becomes normalized for them. And then often they can turn around and think it's perfectly normal to be abusers, or at least to act out some of these things on their peers. And that's very often how they're caught. You know, that's where you get stories of, you know, an 11-year-old who's, you know, doing something with an 8-year-old. Well, right. I mean, that 11-year-old didn't just come out of a vacuum. Obviously they were a victim as well. And, you know, when you combine the very well-known phenomenon that people act out their trauma in negative ways, and then as they grow up and see that it was trauma and not childhood, then there's a big awakening. When you combine that with a theory that all homosexuality is wrong and there must be some explanation for it, I mean, I bet you this therapist thought that he was a hero at some point, thought that he was going to solve this problem for people and joy and happiness.
Problems. I mean, this particular psychiatrist wasn't just dealing with homosexuals. It was people, you know, that were struggling in all kinds of different ways, but for him, it all went back to this, you know, childhood experiences. So he would have this sort of primal therapy. I know it's kind of outdated now, but at one time it was pretty popular, or at least more commonly known. And he would, you know, put them in a state, or try to put them in a state where they were, would go back to their childhood and sort of act out their anger against their parents. Cause it generally was, you know, it's your parents who did something, they made you this way. And so it's almost like, trying to get them in their minds to go back in time. And that's very wishy-washy area. Cause then you get into memories and, you know, you're recovering, you know, and then convincing yourself that you experience certain things because in this weird medicated situation, under psychiatrist care, you're, you know, bringing.
Yeah. Well, you don't even need medication, actually. It's a very well-known phenomenon in memory. I've been asked about it a lot. I was asked once to go to be an expert witness in a court case on memory. The people are watching. I'm in the Guinness Book of Records for memory. I've got a credential there, but I didn't actually end up going to the court case. But it's important to know that you know, false memories are real. It's a weird way to say it, but it's very true. And we have the ability to remember things so scantly. You know, we can remember a moment in our life, and then we can visualize it under hypnosis or under self-hypnosis or even in a relaxed state. And we can kind of spin that around in a 360 view and see it from all angles. And at some point you have to realize, you know, you didn't have eyes in the back of your head. So the rest of it you're making up, and you cannot tell the difference between what is made up and what is real, because they're stored in the brain and essentially created in the same way, in the same format. There was a huge number of scandals of psychologists who, when they discovered hypnotherapy, started using it very liberally. And there was a whole bunch of scandals of talks of sex cults and things like that, where it was believed that there were hundreds, thousands of kids being abused. And then when investigators started to investigate and even arrest people, this is 80s, 90s, and you can look up this period of time. It's a very dark period of time in psychology. Police started to arrest people, and then they started to look for physical evidence, and, you know, places where people said there were dungeons, there weren't dungeons. Places that the kids said existed didn't exist, and they swore up and down that it was real, and so many kids corroborated this. Eventually what investigations found out is that it was the psychologists that were putting these ideas into the children's heads, not knowing that even suggesting something like, look around, tell me what you see, encourages the brain to make stuff up. Like, not even knowing something as simple as that is a suggestion.
Mm-hmm. That he wants to create the story, and sort of like the dreams, you know, these various scenes that you might have, or situations, and then they come together and these clash together in these weird ways when you're dreaming, because the brain wants to make that make sense. So yeah, somebody comes along from the outside and says, hey, this would make sense. Look at this connection. And then,
Well, and then there's also a lot of, you know, around homosexuality, there was the belief around prisons and guys, you know, quote unquote, turning gay when they're behind bars. I think that's just an example of people being frustrated and, you know, being forced to be celibate, to be honest. Yeah. But, you know, there was this idea that it was malleable and there was something people could do about it. It was very, very commonly held. It wasn't even considered an offensive idea. It was considered quite a, how can I say it? Quite a kind notion that there is, you know, a decision process behind it. Today we find this incredibly offensive, but I think we can't erase that past history because, you know, we as human beings, we have a sense that we always think we know what's best. We know what the science says. We know where we're at right now. And we have to realize how many times humanity has gotten that wrong. Time after time after time. We had scientific consensus so many times and it was dead wrong. And there's so many times where we don't really know what we don't know, you know?
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that are not aware of the science. So you take away, you know, that aspect of it, and they're really working in the dark. So it's just what makes common sense to them, which becomes, you know, what they live through and their, you know, all their experiences and their temperament and everything that makes up who they are just becomes this, oh, that is true. I think it, and therefore it is true.
No, that's true. I'll be honest about a point in my life. I'm not ashamed or anything about it, but I don't talk about it much. But I suffered from depression a lot when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And the reason I talk about it is because it shouldn't be something anybody's ashamed of.
I totally agree.
It's a reaction. But I also had some experiences. I remember there was one time, and I've blogged about this before, so I'm not like coming out or anything. But there was one time where I was driving my bike through a park, and this older guy tried to get me in the back of his van, like straight up tried to abduct me. And I got out of that situation, and that like filled my head with all sorts of nonsense for years, you know?
Yes.
So I could totally see, you know, being a young guy in my 20s or something or teens and being depressed and having, you know, questionable experiences. You know, I've had times where, you know, I've been in dangerous situations and stuff, and I have had, you know, my share of kinks like everybody else does. And I could see someone adding that all up and go, oh, that's why you feel shitty and I'm going to solve your problems just by doing this therapy. I can actually see this being like,
definitely.
Yeah, like almost a hopeful thing, like, oh, finally, I'm going to solve this problem. And then he goes to this hospital and what happens?
Yes. And that's just it. There was hope in that. You know, he really wanted to know why this was happening, and it seemed to make sense on some level. And so, God, if you can lift me out of this, please do it, because I'm really suffering. And then the irony is that it becomes torture. And, you know, the way he talks about conversion therapy is like, therapy is just the wrong word and we shouldn't be using it at all, because it's conversion torture. You know, there's nothing about it that's therapeutic. And,
what was it like? Was it like, showing images, and then like I've heard of things like electroshock when you see a gay image and things like, do they do things like that? Was it chemical? What was it?
He was threatened with some weird stuff. There was a number of things that he went through. Like I said, primarily it was these primal therapy sessions where he would lay on a mattress and just start sort of running in place, and then would, you know, be, I don't know, screaming out, you know, scream therapy, you know, screaming out various things and trying to get back to, you know, what caused the homosexuality and dealing with that, you know, just focusing on that, hyper focus on that. But there were other things too. One of them was at one point the doctor had him had some feces in a vial, and he would ask Peter every time he had a homosexual thought to smell it.
Yeah, some sort of like that was a big belief, is that whole conditioning, the stimulus response conditioning to somehow connect it too. Yeah.
Yes. And then he talked about you know, electrodes on his testicles. I mean, that did not happen, but I mean, those are the kinds of things that were coming up, and you know,
It was the threat of that. If this doesn't work, or if you don't do this, then we're going to get more serious.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that the heavy medication was all part of that too. You know, if we can get him to a point where he's just, you know, torn apart, and he really, the story is, you know, 6 years. So it's much too much for me to tell you now, but it really is fascinating. And it's sort of like how he came into it and got into that place. Cause a lot of people will look at that and say, oh, come on, you know, how could you stay in that for 6 years? Right. But it's really, you know, you get into that story and you think, yeah, okay, I see this, you know, in this situation, I can see that. But it's also how he got out and really was able to forgive and heal. And to be honest with you, as a publisher, that's the part that appealed to me, is that this idea of shame and healing and forgiveness, those are universal things. Those are universal themes. And I could apply those to my own life in other ways that were completely not about conversion therapy. But it was so true to, we all have, you know, things in our lives that are, you know, deep-seated or that are disruptive, and that we, you know, we need to forgive other people in order to move on. And and so that to me was really what made it.
How do you bring himself to forgive and move on? I mean,
well,
I'm holding a grudge against the guy who cut me off in traffic 10 years ago. Like, how the hell did you drop something like this?
Well, again, you have to read the book, but I can't say that, you know, there's a lot of forgiveness of the doctor necessarily. Although, you know, he did take steps to, you know, to right that wrong. But it was a lot of forgiveness to other people in his life who had contributed to his depression in the first place. You know, there were a lot of issues with his mother and father, and as there often are, they were very religious, so they were very anti-homosexuality, wouldn't talk to him about it at all. I mean, it's all, you know, it becomes kind of this, you know, this big problem for a lot of reasons. But yeah, a lot of it went back to that, and he was able to find forgiveness in a way that I think is just truly admirable. And
I think part of it also is forgiving himself. And I know that sounds really callous, but I know how the depressed mind works. And any stimulus, any problem, it's your problem. It's your fault, you know, and you blame yourself for everything, things that you wouldn't even believe people would blame themselves for. Being able to truly get past that, like beyond just logically saying, yeah, I know it wasn't my fault, it happened to me. Logic is nothing, but being able to emotionally get to the point where you're not blaming yourself for even getting into that situation or being involved in that, you know, quote unquote therapy. That's the thing that I would love to see the secret sauce for. Cause I think there's a lot of people living these lives of quiet desperation in their own minds because they can't even give themselves a pass.
Exactly. And if you can't give yourself a pass, you can't give anyone else a pass. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the ultimate projection. You know, I can't, if I'm having trouble in my life, or I can't move past this, I can't let you move past it either. I mean, we're, you know,
oh my God. That one line that explains so many failed marriages. I bet, you know, somebody blaming themselves for something, but also not letting a partner move past something because you don't want to move past it. Things like that. It affects all your relationships.
Yeah. Or seeing other people, seeing your flaws in other people, and because you can't accept those flaws in yourself, you come down so hard and you're criticizing them so much and making them feel so bad. With parents, as parents, we do it to our kids all the time. And it's just this ultimate, like, just can we look at ourselves and accept ourselves and not, yes, we should improve in the ways that we can improve, but we're also, you know, we have a responsibility to say, God, yeah, I am not perfect. I am really, really imperfect. And I do these things and it kind of drives me crazy, but you know what? It's okay. It's okay. Mm-hmm. I do that. And then when we do that, other people who do that, we can say, yeah, you know, you do that and it's okay. It's okay. You know?
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating book and it's a fascinating journey. Tell people how they can get a hold of it.
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it in bookstores, not all bookstores, but it is widely available. And on our website is www.brownpaperpress.com and IndieBound, BarnesandNoble.com.
The Inheritance of Shame. It's a great book and really interesting. Thank you very much for doing the interview on this beyond the you know, talking about the world of authors and writing. I encourage other authors to take a look at your press. And I think this is, it's good that we talked about one of your top authors, because, you know, that shows the type of books that you're trying to get out there, because it's really important that this word get out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much our mission to publish books that really matter and might push us into a better place.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.